And so Barney's become a very close friend. He's always saying he loves me, and it's a little creepy. We also purchased the magazine Inventor's Digest. How many here are subscribers to Inventor's Digest? Got a couple? Inventor's Digest, believe it or not, has been around for 25 years. The magazine kind of went through a variety of different phases, but when we purchased the magazine 2 years ago, it was a quarterly publication. And what we've tried to do is breathe some new life into it. For those of you who get the magazine, what do you think so far? It's good? The magazine is now a monthly publication. We've put a lot of time, a lot of resources into it. It's by far my single largest charity that I give to every single month. But it's something that the inventor community needs. It has great informative stories and inspiring stories in it, and it provides resources that inventors need. And so it's another resource available for the inventor community. But the last piece of the puzzle was creating a real community. And one of the things that I noticed at these casting calls that we would have is that inventors want to help each other out. Inventors all of a sudden become instant friends. They start talking to each other about resources that are available or experiences that they've had, successes or failures that they've experienced. I also see these clubs where you all congregate and you learn from other people's experiences. You pass on references and recommendations, and you have this community. So last year, we created a virtual community online at edisonnation.com. And at Edison Nation, or initially, the purpose was to disseminate information, to provide the resources that inventors need to avoid making mistakes. But the biggest opportunity that Edison Nation creates is a conduit between companies that want innovation and inventors who can solve problems. And in our live product searches, we work with the largest retailers out there, Walmart, Home Depot, Bed Bath & Beyond, PetSmart, Staples, Dick's Sporting Goods. Those companies are looking for ideas. They're looking for new and innovative products for their store shelves. And if you've got an answer to what they're looking for, you receive royalties for the life of the product. You don't have to file a patent. You don't have to build a prototype. You just have to answer what they're looking for. It's a very safe and secure environment. And since launching Edison last year, we've had 23 successful searches where every single search has resulted in at least one licensed product. We've yet to fail. We've yet to have a search where the inventor community hasn't found a product for a manufacturer or a retailer and been able to be successful with that. So that's another resource that's available. So let's talk about ideas.
Can I ask, the searches that those companies want, is that for a lower cost equivalent product?
No, in most cases it's an innovative product. So Coca-Cola was looking for a beverage that wasn't isotonic, wasn't cola, wasn't water, wasn't a fruit juice. Very narrow search. Bed Bath & Beyond was looking for a problem-solving product invented by a woman. PetSmart was looking for an interactive dog toy. Procter & Gamble is looking for a product that removes pet hair from upholstery. WD-40 was looking for a new product that can apply WD-40. So it just runs the gamut from very wide searches like lifetime
it's
products.
It's a functional kind of request.
It is. Yeah, and sometimes they're very narrow and sometimes they're extremely broad. So let's talk about ideas. We all have them. They're cheap. Okay? There's no value in just an idea. An idea has to be turned into a product. So how do you get from that idea, that eureka moment in the shower, to something that you can actually make money from? Well, what we understand is that going from a great idea to something that you can make money from requires execution. In most cases, you're not going to be rewarded for just coming in to work and saying, hey, I've got this great idea, but not doing anything with it. Ideas are very easy to come up with. We can come up with lots of ideas in our lifetime, but turning an idea into a product, in many cases, requires financial resources, it's an investment of time, and in many cases what you're hoping for is a little luck along the way. Why do we do it? Well, innovation's a hot topic. And if you pick up any magazine or any newspaper or if you listen to the president speak, he's talking about innovation. Innovation's important right now because when you start looking at some of the largest consumer product companies, over 50% of their revenue is coming from products that are less than 2 years old, which is pretty amazing when you think about it. When we were younger, there wasn't this constant evolution of products. I mean, I remember as a kid, there was maybe two types of toothpaste. One was in a red and white, one was in a blue and white tube. Today, you go into the toothpaste section, you've got to spend 30 minutes there looking at all the different varieties. There's whitening, there's tartar control, there's good breath, there's gels, there's paste, there's sprinkles, there's everything that you can imagine. Because consumers today, we want new and improved. We're always looking for something that meets or exceeds our expectations. And so as a result, companies are constantly looking for ways to stay in front of the competition, or innovation is a way to level the playing field, where an entrepreneur, where a startup can compete with some of the biggest companies out there because they can level the playing field and bring something new to the marketplace. So when we start looking at innovation, we've got to understand the relationship between risks and rewards. And bringing a new product to business is no different than starting a business. All right? We've got to understand that the risks associated with starting a business are the same as the risks associated with bringing a new product to market. In many cases, you're going to invest a lot of money into the process. There's no guarantees of success. It's going to be time-consuming. Along the way, there's liabilities. You may create a product that causes harm to someone or damages their property. Or you may inadvertently infringe on someone else's intellectual property. But I think the biggest risk associated with invention, the biggest risk associated with becoming an entrepreneur, is failure. No one wants to fail. I mean, how would you feel about quitting your job, investing all the kids' college education or the 401k into bringing a new product to market, and you're not successful, and you've got a garage full of product? A lot of people stay on the sidelines because they just don't want to get into the game. They're afraid of what's going to happen. But we also need to look at the rewards. And if you do it properly, and if you pursue an idea that is feasible, there's financial success. There's that self-accomplishment that you can be recognized as the person who brought something to market. You can be recognized for that success. In many cases, it's just satisfaction that you actually wanted to follow through with something that you said you were going to do. What you need to understand is the product development process is expensive. There's no shortcuts here. It doesn't just happen overnight. It's going to be an investment. And if it's not an investment of significant dollars, it's definitely going to be an investment of time and resources. There's no guarantees of success. As much as you believe you've got a great product and your friends and family tell you it's a great product, the marketplace ultimately is going to be the judge of whether your product is good or not. You've got to focus on the return on investment. Don't get hung up on what the cost to bring your product to market is. I don't care if it costs you $2,000 or $2 million. If you can't make money from it, you shouldn't be doing it. You've got to focus on what you're going to make and whether or not that return is enough to justify the risks that you're going to be assuming. So how do we do it? Before you start spending money, before you run to your patent attorney, before you start building prototypes, before you pull your wallet out of your pocket, you've got to determine whether or not your idea is feasible. And I know we all want to rush out there and become inventors. We all want to go out there and strike gold. But before we strike gold, we've got to make sure there's actually gold in the ground. And so we've got to determine whether or not our idea is feasible before we start this process. And so what I've done is I've boiled it down to five questions that you need to be able to answer before you start. That first question is, what is your product? And I'm going to let you in on a secret. I hate to do this, but the fact of the matter is all the inventions that you have, all the great ideas that you're thinking of right now, we don't need any of them. We don't. Think of how long we've gotten by without your inventions. My guess is tomorrow we'll still exist without your inventions. We don't need any new products. We've got enough. But there's a huge difference between needing something and wanting something. And tomorrow people will want to buy something. They will want to buy something that makes their life easier. They'll want to buy something that they aspire to own. They will want to buy something that brings joy to their life. So you've got to understand there's a huge difference between needs and wants. And you've got to figure out what it is about your product that's unique. Because your product just is a substitution for something else that already exists. Your product has to stand out and give the consumer a reason to purchase it over something else that meets their basic core needs. So what is unique about it? How does it differ from your competition? If consumers are already buying the competition, how are you going to differentiate yours from theirs? Maybe your product's more convenient. Maybe it's easier to use. In some cases, it may be the style of the product or the design. As consumers, we like things that are visually appealing. So we've got to really figure out what differentiates the product. But most importantly, what's the value proposition? What is the consumer trading their dollars for? Are they getting more time with their family? Are they getting something that brings them happiness? Are they getting something that saves them money in the long run? So the value proposition is what we really have to hone in on. So we look at products out there. Dish soap, right? Nothing that unique about it. Glycerin and water. You squirt it on dishes, it makes bubbles, it cleans the plates. So why would you innovate in a category like dish soap? It's a commodity. Well, two guys thought that they could do something better. They observed the process of washing dishes. It goes something like this. You've got a bottle of dish soap, it's ugly, you store it underneath the sink. So you reach down, you grab it, you flip the cap open. You turn it upside down, you squirt it on a sponge or a plate. You turn it back over, put the top down, reach under, put it underneath the sink, and then you do your dishes. These two guys observed that process and said, can we make this better? How can we be unique? So they did two things from an intellectual property standpoint. First, they hired a very famous industrial designer, Karim Rashid, to design a bottle that was appealing, that looked good on the counter rather than underneath the sink. Secondly, they invented a valve that prevents the fluid from leaking onto the counter, so it could always be facing down. So now the process is you grab it, you squeeze it, you put it down. It's easier. And how much do you think they charge for that? Less? A lot more. And last year they sold hundreds of millions of dollars of dish soap. Did we need another brand of dish soap? No. Could we have lived the rest of our lives without Method? Absolutely. But people want to buy this because people like it better. You look at some innovations that are completely disruptive. How many people have DVRs or TiVo? Can you imagine life without it today? I mean, I'm at my hotel, and my wife calls, and I'm watching SportsCenter, and instinctively I go for the remote control to hit pause so I don't miss what's on TV, only to find out that I don't have TiVo in my hotel. It's changed the way we interact with programming. Yet 10 years ago, 15 years ago, if I asked the same group, do we need to take control of our content, we wouldn't have said yes because we didn't know that was an option. TiVo and DVRs were a disruptive technology. It changed our behaviors. It's true innovation because it anticipated what our needs were going to be before we even knew we needed them. And then sometimes innovation is just silly. I mean, who ever thought that wearing a bathrobe backwards would sell millions and millions of dollars worth of product?
That sells millions and millions.
The Snuggies sold 4 million units in the first 3 months it was launched. They are well over $100 million in revenue on a blanket with sleeves.
You've got to write that down.
Are there any patents? No. Do we need this? Well, I guess we do. Because if we can't get our remote control out from underneath the blanket, we may miss something. People want to buy things.
Why don't they need a patent?
Why don't they?
Yes.
There's no intellectual property there. Monks have been wearing that for years. Right? I mean, there's a bunch of monks out there saying, man, if we just would have followed through with that great idea, we'd be millionaires right now.
Maybe. marketing, isn't it?
Oh, it's all marketing. Right, yeah. I mean, this is one of those things that went completely viral. The infomercials are so silly that people love to buy it just to say they have it. There's beer crawls where people go to bars and they go from bar to bar wearing their Snuggies. There's clubs out there. I mean, it's the company that introduced the Snuggies just introduced a Snuggies for dogs last month. So if you thought that it wasn't enough to own one of these for yourself, now your pet actually has one as well. Okay? So innovation can be kind of silly sometimes as well. So first question we got to answer is, what is unique about our product? What's going to differentiate it from everything else out there? Second question, who's your customer? As much as you'd like to believe that everyone in the world is your customer, or everyone in the United States is going to buy your product, in reality, that's just not the case. What you really have to do is you've got to paint a picture of who your customer is. How old are they? How much do they make? What's their education level? Geographically, where are they located? The reason we do this, if we know that the target consumer for our product is a male who's 28 to 34 years old, has a college education, is living in the Southeast, we can pull census data and say, well, there's 3.1 million of those people out there. So instead of saying, well, our market is 330 million inhabitants of the United States, and if we just sell 1% of the U.S. population, boy, we're going to make a lot of money. Well, if your customer is that male who's 28 to 34 with a college education making $75,000 a year living in the Southeast, you may find that your market is a fraction of that. And it, instead of getting 1% of the U.S. population, you got to get 90% of your target market. And that might not be realistic. So if you know how big your pool is, if you know how big your customer base is, it's a lot easier to forecast the probability of reaching that pool. It also, from a marketing standpoint, is much more efficient because instead of just broadcasting out there hoping someone hears it, you're pinpointing your message to the people who actually can buy your product. So if we understand who our customer is, then the third question we've got to ask is, how are they going to react? And so how do we find out how consumers are going to react to our product? Not a trick question.
Focus group.
Ask them, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can ask them. If we know who our customer is, if we're able to paint that picture of their age, their demographic information, their educational level, etc., we can find these people. We can find out questions like, is there really a need for this? Or do consumers want this product? We can find out from these consumers whether or not they're making the purchasing decision, or maybe someone else, maybe they just influence the decision. For example, you may have a product where the user is that male who's 28 to 34, but maybe it's his spouse that actually makes the purchase. You can find out what drives the purchasing decision. Is it an emotional decision? Is it response to a need? Is it something that people aspire to own? What's going to trigger the purchase decision? We also want to find things out like, where would they buy it from? And how much would they pay for it? And how often would they purchase it? Those are all important questions to find out. I met an inventor at one of our casting calls who had a really clever product. She created this plastic mannequin that allows a parent to lay out the child's clothes the night before. So when the child wakes up, the clothes are hanging on this mannequin, and the kid knows exactly what to put on in the morning. Very clever. I've got two kids. I would definitely buy it. She had invested in patents and in design work and engineering. She tooled up, manufactured the product, and made an initial order of the product. In all, she'd invested over $300,000 in her product. Very, very clever product. She brought the product to a casting call, and my first reaction was, how much does it sell for? Now, let me ask everyone in this room, how much do you think a product like that, how much would you pay for that product?
$29, $30.
Yeah, exactly what I was thinking. Somewhere between $29 and $39, I wouldn't think twice about buying that. Her price, $179.
Whoa.
Why? because it cost her over $70 a unit just to manufacture the product. And that was before she even amortized her tooling in and her development costs. She spent a lot of money without asking a very basic question, and that is, how much would you pay for this? If she would have known how much consumers would pay and how much it was going to cost her to bring her product to market, she should never have spent the first dollar. She should have stopped at questions. So,
but it depends. If this product for whole family, maybe they will pay $100.
How many people? But
maybe for whole
through traditional retail channels, though, at $70 manufactured cost, if she wanted to sell through a traditional retailer, she would have to charge it four times what her FOB cost is. That product would have to retail for $279.
Wow.
I'm not sure there's a parent out there, even if it was for the whole family, would spend $279 for something that lays out the clothes on a mannequin. Plus, yeah, exactly. You can buy a lot of hangers for that. So, if we want to find out whether or not consumers want our product, we ask them, right? And there's a lot of ways we can do this. One is we can do surveys. The internet's made it a lot easier to gather a lot of data from consumers. There are online resources like Zoomerang and SurveyMonkey, which allow you to pose questions to a large group of targeted consumers. It's not spam. These people opt in to answer these questions. And you don't necessarily have to disclose your invention. What you really want to target is, what's the pain? What is the consumer suffering from? And is it a big enough pain to justify the remedy that you're trying to sell? If you've got a product, maybe it's a baby product. You want to target moms who have babies. You want to find out whether or not they have the same pain. How are they solving that pain? Or how much would they spend to eliminate the pain? You haven't disclosed your invention. What you're really trying to figure out is what's going to trigger that purchasing decision. You could go out and go on to bulletin boards. So again, there are communities out there, whether it's for moms or hobby enthusiasts or sports fans or whatever it may be. Go to one of these message boards where people who are your consumers congregate and find out what issues they face and how do they deal with it. You can do face-to-face focus groups where you gather a bunch of people together. Ideally, you sign a confidentiality agreement with those individuals, and maybe you get interaction with your specific product. Or you can do one-on-one interviews where you target who your customer is and really talk with them about your product and what the need is. If you've got a great pet product, where are you going to find a pet owner? Yeah, either coming in and out of a pet store, or my guess is if you go to a park and they're holding a leash, there's a really good chance that they own a dog. So if you've got a dog product, find someone holding a leash and ask them a few questions. Ask them about the need. Is this something that they would buy? How much would they pay for it? Where would they expect to buy it from? How often would they purchase it? These are questions we've got to answer. I know your mom tells you you've got a great product, your dad tells you you've got a great product, your family tells you you've got a great product, but unless they're going to buy a whole lot of it, you better talk to your customers as well. So, we go to question number four, and that is, how much money is it going to take? This is something that is so fundamental, so important to figure out before you get started. If this afternoon I decided I'm going to go to California, here I am in Connecticut, I'm going to go to California, I got $40 in my pocket, that gets me started, I'm off. How far before I run into problems?
I'll take a guess later.
Yeah, about 300 miles from now, I'm going to start saying, what am I going to do? Well, I'll call friends and family, right? Friends and family is a good place to get money. And maybe they can lend me a little money to get me a little further along. Or maybe I can borrow money from a bank. But if I can't find the money that I need, guess what? I'm not going to get to my destination, and I may not get back. I'm going to be stranded somewhere in the middle. And that's what inventors and entrepreneurs do, is they start off saying, well, I got money in the checking account or the 401k, or I've got money in the kids' college education fund. Let's get started. Let's get in the car. Let's start driving, because I've heard about this destination. It's so much fun. And somewhere along the way, it gets a little bit more expensive than what you expected. It ends up costing more than you budgeted, and you run the risk of losing everything because you can't get to the final destination, to where you can actually make money from your idea. So before you start, you've got to figure out how much you need. And so the way we do it is we start with our startup budget. All right? What expenses do we expect to incur? We don't have to make these up. We can call a patent attorney and ask them, how much do you typically charge for a patent? I've got a mechanical invention that does something like this. Give me a ballpark. You can talk with a design firm or an engineering firm. They will quote you what it's going to cost to turn your idea into a prototype. You can talk with a manufacturer, and they can give you a ballpark what it would cost for the molds or the tooling to manufacture your product. And based on the size and the materials, they can give you a ballpark cost on what it should cost to manufacture the product. So you can forecast what these startup costs are going to be before you get started. Then you've got to make that decision. Do you want to license your invention, or do you want to simply go into business and become an entrepreneur? And if you choose that route, then what you've got to do is you've got to figure out what the operational costs are of running your business. What kind of revenue are you anticipating? What are your cost of goods sold going to be? What's your selling and general administrative expenses going to be? And will you have a net profit or a loss? So you pull out Excel and you flow it out. You make assumptions, realistic assumptions, based on what your revenue is going to be. You know what your cost of goods are going to be because your manufacturer can tell you that. And so you know what your gross profit should be. You can budget what your selling, general, and administrative expenses will be. A landlord will tell you how much rent is. The utility company will tell you on average what the utilities for that place will be. You can forecast what you're going to spend in marketing and travel and everything else. And at the end, you can figure out whether or not you can show a profit or not. You should do this not only for a year, but for 3 years, under a best case, a worst case, and a most likely scenario. Because what you really have to decide is if there's enough juice for the squeeze. Can you make enough money to justify the opportunity costs? Does it make sense to quit a job where you're making $80,000 a year, to start a business, risk a lot, and make a profit at 26? I don't know. It depends. Depends on how you measure success. If success to you is about making more than what you're making at your current job, the answer is no. If success is defined as actually following through and benefiting humanity with your invention, the answer may be yes. But what we've got to do is we've got to understand that relationship between risk and reward and determine whether or not it's worth the risk. And we can only do that by flowing it out, by building a spreadsheet and figuring out whether or not there's money to be made or not. Again, it's about return on investment. If I told you right now that for every person who walks up here that gives me a dollar, I'll give you 80 cents back, how many people are going to jump up here? Come on, start bringing me the dollars. All right, we'll increase the odds. For every person who comes up here and gives me $100, I'll give you $90 back. If I told you that if you gave me $100,000, I'd give you $500,000 back, would you do it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. If I told you it was $10 million and I'd give you $100 million back, would you do it?
Yeah.
You may not have $10 million, but you'd find a way to get it. You've got to focus on what the return is, not on how cheaply you can get to market. If someone tells you you can bring your product to market for $10,000, but you're only going to make $8,000 off of it, does that make sense? No. So don't get wrapped up on what the cost to develop the product is. You've got to focus on the results, the return you're going to generate off of that investment. Bottom line is, if the numbers don't add up, don't do it. So the fifth question is, once we know how much money we need, where's that money going to come from? Well, friends and family is always a good place to go. Friends and family will invest in your ideas because they're investing in you. They believe in you. And hopefully, they're going to be a little bit more lenient if you're not able to pay them back right away. There was a time that banks lent money. I hear that it may happen again. Depends on how much TARP funds we give them first. But what banks really do, kidding aside, is banks just provide liquidity. I mean, banks don't want to be your business partner. Banks lend you money you already have. So if you have money in your house, if you have money in stocks and bonds, if you have money in your credit worthiness, they'll lend you money knowing that there's collateral behind it. They don't want to invest in prototypes and businesses. They want to invest in assets. Private equity is a good place to go for dollars. These are normally high net worth individuals who are willing to invest in entrepreneurs and startups for a much bigger return than they can get in the stock market. But you got to get creative. Sometimes going through the traditional sources doesn't work. If you've got a great product that's going to provide value, you may find that your customer is a great source of startup dollars. Either actually prepaying for the product, or in many cases, just giving you a purchase order becomes an asset that you can collateralize. If you've got a customer who's looking at buying your product, and they're reputable and bank worthy, you can take that purchase order to a factor or a bank, and they'll lend you money on that purchase order because they know you're going to get paid at some point when you deliver. In some cases, you may find that your vendors are a great source of startup dollars. We're struggling to keep manufacturing here in the U.S. So if you've got a product that could be produced here in the U.S., you may find a vendor who says, look, I'll manufacture it for you, and instead of paying me up front or in 30 days, you can pay me in 120 days. That's what we call dating. And so by dating that invoice, you'd have the ability to sell your product, collect the funds, pay the vendor, and everyone benefits. The bottom line is, you can't focus on the cost to develop. You've got to really focus on the return. I've never seen a situation where a good idea doesn't get financed. What I see a lot are ideas that people think are great ideas, and then they complain that no one understands the ideas and they won't invest in the ideas. If you've got a product and you can demonstrate that there's demand and that there can be an economic return from selling that product, you will find people who will invest in it. It's that simple. I mean, that's just how capitalism works. Typically what happens is that the product doesn't have enough potential for huge success, the risks are too high, and the investment community just says the risks outweigh the rewards. What you really have to do is focus on the ideas that will generate success. And if the numbers don't add up on this one, don't do it. There's no statute of limitations for inventors. There's an inventor out this way, Saul Palder. Anyone ever hear of Saul Palder? Saul Palder was 78 years old when he came up with his best invention, or at least the one that made him the most money. The pain that Saul was trying to solve was every time he would go into the cabinet to look for a food storage container, besides all of them falling out, he'd find a bowl, but he couldn't find the lid. Or he'd find the lid and he couldn't find the matching bowl. So Saul decided that his experience must be pretty uniform, that a lot of people must have the same experience. So he started working on a prototype that had three different bases, three different bowls with one size lid, and would be organized in a Lazy Susan type carousel. So it would clean up all the clutter and make it easy to find the right lid for the right base. Saul would meet at a McDonald's with a local designer every day. They would work on his prototype, work on his drawings. Saul didn't have the time or the financial resources to commercialize his invention. He didn't want to be an entrepreneur. So he offered it to Paul Newman's foundation. He sent a letter to Paul Newman's foundation and told Mr. Newman that if he commercialized the product, the foundation could keep all the money. Never heard back. Eventually he found an infomercial person who helped get the product on air, and in the first 6 months, the product sold over $120 million worth. Wow. So I got 50 cents on every unit that was sold. It's all made millions and millions of dollars. Not because it was his first invention, but it was his best invention. It was the invention that gave him the greatest chance for success. It took him until he was 78. But the fact is that you don't have to move forward on the first idea that you have. Because my guess is it won't be your last. What you really have to focus on is the idea that's going to make you the most money. So what are the next steps? Well, first you got to find the money. Don't start the journey if you don't know how you're going to pay for it. Not only is it a recipe for failure, it ruins the fun. Make sure you've got the dollars that you need to start this process. Second, you've got to protect your idea. There is value in intellectual property, especially if it's a product that has a huge market and a long life to it. Now, that's not to say that intellectual property or patents are right for every single product. In some cases, you may find that a brand or a trademark is just as effective in bringing your product to market. I'm drinking Dasani water. Think there's any patents on this? No. There were a lot of different bottles of water in the gas station. I chose this because of the brand, because of the trademark, because of the promise of the quality and consistency of this product. I paid more for it, not because of the patents, but because of the trademark. In some cases, being first to market is all that you need to do. Right now, pendency is 32 months. 32 months from the date you file a patent till the time you'll get an office action. In many cases, technology changes before you even get a patent. So you've got to understand, what are you really protecting? And does it make sense to get a patent at all? You've got to develop a proof of concept prototype. You've got to be able to communicate your idea and how it works and what the value proposition is. Regardless of whether you're going to become an entrepreneur and bring your product to market yourself or license your invention to someone else, at the very least, you've got to be able to demonstrate that it works. In many cases, establishing a brand and marketing your product is important. And then you've got to make that decision. Do you sell your product, become an entrepreneur, go to market with it, or does it make more sense to just license the invention and let someone else do all the heavy lifting? When you start to look at how difficult it is to bring a product to market, you've got to look at reality. All right? If you go into Home Depot, if you go into Walmart, if you go into Bed Bath & Beyond, if you go into a major retailer, when was the last time you saw big gaping holes on the shelf? You don't, do you?
Only the ones going out of business.
The ones going out of business, absolutely. But they don't pay their vendors, so that's probably not a customer you want to do business with. Reality is, to sell a product today requires them not to buy something else. So when you go and you believe you've got a great product, you don't have to convince someone you've got a great product. You've got to convince them that your product is better than what they're already selling. So if you want to sell a product to Home Depot, they're going to have to buy one less thing to buy yours. When you look at the buyers out there, the buyers for these major retailers, they're young, they're overworked, and they're underpaid. They don't like risk. They don't want to get bashed on by their supervisor for taking a risk on a product that's not proven. It's a lot easier for them to keep selling what they already have than bring something else new in. So don't have aspirations of conquering Bentonville, Arkansas the first day. What you need to do is you need to get traction. You've got to prove that there is demand for your product. Start small. Start selling to some small local retailers, catalog, online retailers. Get some sales rolling. Once you start to generate sales, then you go in with a different level of confidence and you have traction. Because now you can go to these retailers and you can say, I've been selling this product for the last 6 months or the last 12 months. I've sold this number of units through these channels. I've got this amount of repeat business. Now it's not as risky a proposition as it was when you were trying to be the first sale. In some cases, it may make more sense to just license your product. license it to a company that's already in the space or to a company that's looking at getting into that space. The advantage is they already have the relationship with those retailers. They're already selling into that channel. They already have that shelf space. So in many cases, your product may be an improvement to what they're already selling. You know, last year, I got to spend a couple days with James Dyson. James Dyson is the inventor of the Dyson vacuum cleaner. And so if you've ever seen his TV commercials, he loves to talk about his 5,127 prototypes. But what James Dyson doesn't talk about is the fact that he didn't want to become an entrepreneur. He didn't want to be the king of vacuums. James just didn't want to hear his wife complain about the vacuum cleaner. He'd come home from work every day, and his wife would complain that the vacuum cleaner wasn't working. So he would take it apart, he would put a new bag in, and voila, it worked. A few weeks would go by, he'd come home, honey, the vacuum cleaner's not working. Now, of course, his wife said it in this great English accent, and so it sounds a lot better than the way I'm explaining it. But he would take apart the vacuum cleaner, he'd realize that the bag wasn't even full, yet it still was losing suction, and it was because all the dust inside of the bag was clogging the pores. That didn't make sense to him, because when he would go to work every day, he went by a lumber mill that had a big cyclonic vacuum system on the roof that didn't clog, that sucked up sawdust all day long. So James decided he was going to figure this out. And so using some cereal boxes and gaffer's tape, he built a prototype. And he was able to create a vacuum cleaner that didn't need a bag, that didn't lose suction. So he was pretty excited about it. He went to work the next day. He had a business with his brother-in-law and family friend called Kirk Dyson. And he said, guys, I've created a vacuum cleaner that doesn't use a bag, that doesn't lose suction. And his supportive brother-in-law and family friend said, James, if there was a better vacuum cleaner out there, Hoover or Eureka would have already come out with it. And so not only did they dump cold water on his idea, but they were matter of fact in saying that if he wanted to pursue this invention, he would have to leave the company. And that's what he did. He left the company. He pursued his invention. He built prototypes, he filed patents, and he started talking with vacuum cleaner manufacturers in the UK. And guess what? No one would see him. No one was interested. He came here to the United States thinking, hey, we got a lot of vacuum cleaner companies here. You know what they told him? It's disruptive. We make a lot of money selling bags. Why would we want to put a vacuum cleaner on the marketplace that doesn't have bags? That'd be like selling razor handles that don't need razors, right? There's a lot of money in that. His patents were infringed on. No one would take him serious. No one would manufacture the product for him. So eventually, almost 8 years into it, he started making them himself and sold them in Japan and received moderate success. Last year, he sold over $1 billion in vacuum cleaners. He didn't want to be an entrepreneur, but he found that the road to licensing was a dead end for him. And so he had to make a decision to either give up or find a different path. And so he chose the different path. So, what other resources are available out there for inventors? The USPTO has great resources. They've got resources for independent inventors. Obviously, you can search patents at uspto.gov. There is an independent inventors conference every year in Alexandria. The next one, I believe, is it's supposed to be posted on the website this week. I think it's in November. Inventors Digest. If you have not checked out Inventors Digest, just go to the website. There are so many articles up. It's all free. Learn from the pros. Learn from others who have been successful. There is a special offer, you know, for subscribers. I believe it's $27 a year. Normally it's $36. It's a small investment to make to be inspired and to learn from other inventors. Everyday Edisons, as I mentioned, we're in our third season of production. And so season three will air in the beginning of next year. And then we'll announce our casting calls for season four shortly. And then there's Edison Nation. And if you haven't checked out Edison Nation, it's the one thing that I strongly urge you to do when you get home tonight. It's free. It doesn't cost anything to join. When you go to Edison Nation, create a profile, request me as a friend. It's a great way for us to communicate. But more importantly, what I'll do is when I'm finished this month of all these seminars that I'm doing, I'll provide to a random number of people on Edison Nation free access to the pros in our company and who are on Everyday Edisons, industrial designers, engineers, patent attorneys, branding and marketing people, give you an hour's worth of time to ask those people how to do it. And so we're gonna select a few people from everyone who makes me their friend, so at least I know who has registered, and then we'll throw that out there. And again, it's free. There are a number of searches going on. Every single month there's about five. You may just find that a company is looking for something that you've already thought about, and you don't have to invest any dollars into it. That if they choose the product, they'll commercialize it. And then the whole reason why I've come out here is a book that I've written. It's my first book, and I promise you it's my last book. I never wanted to be an author. I enjoy talking with people, but I find that I talk about the same things over and over again, and so it was a whole lot easier to put it all in a book, so this way there was a reference that people can take after this was all done. Workman Publishing paid the dollars for me to be out here. Normally, this wouldn't be something that most inventor clubs could do. I mean, you know, $1,000 in airfare and hotel and, you know, travel to get me to a club, which I'm happy to volunteer my time to do, but Workman put up the dollars for it. Will they sell enough books to justify it? No. I mean, they got to sell a whole lot more than that stack of books to pay for this event, but it's their investment back into the inventor community. And so hopefully, one, you find the book informative, and it's a good resource for you. And secondly, I think Workman hopes that you'll tell other people about it. And if it is something that has value, then hopefully you'll tell others as well. So with that, that's my story. What I find is that it's a lot more effective to answer your questions. So I'll leave the floor open for as long as you guys want to stick around to ask me any questions that you have. Yes?
I have a question about Edison Nation. So I'm a member there, and I've submitted ideas, and it's great. I think it's a wonderful place, and they do have major corporations asking for different things. What I'd like to know is, so when you get rejected and you don't make it to a green 8, you never know why. So and you guys have put up a bar now that says, well, in this category, this stage, this is what they're looking for, et cetera, et cetera. And so then you can submit an idea, your same idea, to another manufacturer if it fits, and that's great. How do you know when, like, okay, enough, you know, we're not doing you because there's a patent out there, or we're not doing you because, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's not easy to provide that kind of feedback for every inventor. And you can imagine when we get hundreds or thousands of submissions, if Procter & Gamble says they're looking for a device to remove hair from upholstery, they have given a criteria to you, the inventor, as well as to us on how to screen it, and they've tried to be specific in what they want and what they don't want. But in many cases, it may not be patentable. There may be existing prior art that would, you know, preclude it from being patented. In some cases, maybe something they're already working on. So there are so many different reasons why an idea may not be chosen, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's not a good idea. It just means it doesn't fit the criteria of what that manufacturer is looking for. And so we don't want to tell an inventor that it's not a good idea. It just doesn't fit the criteria of that specific search. And that's why we allow, like in your situation, or anyone on Edison Nation, to resubmit to other searches at no cost. Because, give you a perfect example, we had a search with Bed Bath & Beyond for kitchen products, and shortly thereafter, a search with Lifetime Products for kitchen products. So we're giving the inventors multiple opportunities to find a home for their idea. What doesn't work for one company may work better for another. A lot of inventors have asked, can we provide more feedback for a fee? We don't want to be in the invention promotion business or invention review business, because who are we to say? I mean, if someone brought me the Snuggies, I would have laughed, right? Someone brought me a blanket with sleeves and said, this is a great product, I would have said, you're wasting my time. The process Determining whether an idea is a good idea or not is somewhat subjective, and a lot of it just really depends on whether or not there's a market for it. So what's safer for us is to screen ideas based on what the manufacturer is looking for. And so what we're able to give inventors is access through the front door with the largest retailers and manufacturers in the U.S. An opportunity, you know, we presented to PetSmart 3 weeks ago for their search. 41 products were brought to Phoenix to show to PetSmart out of the hundreds that were submitted. That's 41 inventors who got to get their product in front of a buyer at the largest pet store in the U.S. My guess is those 41 people never would have been able to do it on their own. Maybe a few of them would have found a way to do it, but most likely they wouldn't have. And out of those 41, I think 14 were chosen. So that's a pretty good bet. But I'm sorry, we can't give you more information on why specifically. Hopefully these questions help define whether or not it's a good product or not.
I'm not familiar with Edison Nation, how it works. Do you charge fees for any of these submissions? And to be blunt, what do you get out of it?
Yeah. Well, I'll answer that in two answers. First off, there's no cost to join Edison Nation. It's free. Right. All the forums, all the information is all free. To submit an idea, there is a fee. It's $25 or $20 if you're a gold member. And the reason why we charge a fee is to actually keep people from submitting garbage. What we looked at is what was the lowest fee that wouldn't inhibit someone from submitting an idea, but at the same time be just enough that people just don't dump a database of ideas into our lap and say, review all these for free. Now, if anyone's ever reviewed an idea, there's no way we can do a patent review, feasibility, and all that for $25, but we do. So we lose money on every submission that comes in, but what we hope is that $25 will be enough of a deterrent that we'll just get good ideas. What do we get out of it? It's a 50-50 deal. So if through this process we're able to license the product to PetSmart or Bed Bath & Beyond or Procter & Gamble, we split the revenue 50-50. Now, we of course file the patents, we build the prototypes, we do whatever work that the retailer needs us to get that product market ready to the point where they'll pull the trigger. We do that at our expense. The revenue, the 50-50 split, is from dollar number one. There's no recapture of our expenses. So what we're doing is we're making bets. We're making bets that the best ideas are still out there and that we'll partner with it, that we'll build the conduit, and that we'll help those ideas get to market.
I'm sorry, using starts from dollar number one, that means you accumulate a certain amount of your investment to go forward. It has to be repeated.
No.
He's saying they
as soon as PetSmart chooses, the inventor gets $2,500 immediately. So there's a $2,500 success fee that's paid to the inventor as soon as the search is concluded and their idea is chosen. So they're already 100 times their initial investment, right? Yeah. And then the first royalty that comes in
goes
50-50 to the inventor. So obviously we've got to believe that there's enough in that product to get our investment out, because you know at the very least we may have $20,000-$30,000 in patent work involved in it. Or in some cases, we might not have anything. In some cases, the inventor's done a lot of the work and the retailer just sources it. Edison Nation is not a resource for someone who wants to go to market themselves. If you've got the product, if you've manufactured it, if you've got inventory, get in front of that retailer yourself and do it. There's no reason for us. What Edison Nation really is for people who have ideas that want to see value from only an idea. I mean, let's face it, you can't get paid for ideas. I mean, if you come up with a great idea today, no one's going to give you money for it. But if a specific company says, this is what we're looking for, and we act as a conduit to take that solution and protect it, then there's value in it.
What's the protection? You just sign an NDA with the inventor?
Yeah, the submission process, obviously there's an NDA between us and the manufacturer or retailer. So we've got that protection between us and them. And then, of course, when you're submitting it to us, no one else is seeing it. So it's not, you're not posting it on a forum. You're sending it to us. We're going to screen it. We're going to match it against the criteria of that manufacturer or retailer. And then, obviously, we want to get a deal done. We want as many products as we can to be licensed by those retailers, because what's good for us is good for you and vice versa.
Do you typically need to have a prototype before you?
Not necessarily.
So it's ideas and
yeah, you know, the search we did for Coca-Cola, I mentioned, their criteria. Can't be cola, can't be isotonic like Gatorade, can't be water, and can't be a fruit juice. Okay? How many beverages come to mind? Right? That was their search criteria. We had a couple hundred submissions. I was really concerned before we started that we wouldn't find any. Coca-Cola licensed one of the products. Did they have a prototype? No. Did they have a patent? No. Did they have a brand? No. What they had was an answer to the question that Coca-Cola was looking for. And they got their $2,500, and they're going to collect royalties on the sales of this product. I didn't taste it. They didn't send a sample of it. They just were able to describe what the invention is, and that was enough for the people at Coke to say, we love it. And when you see this product, when we're able to actually tell people what it is, everyone's going to just hit themselves on the side of the head and be like, I can't believe someone didn't come up with this years ago.
If I could just say, even for the WD-40, you would think, oh my God, you know, you have to be a chemist or something. You didn't need a formula or anything.
Yeah, last year WD-40 introduced a new WD-40. I mean, I think the average house has like 2.3 cans of WD-40, right? Yet. Huh?
No, we could find the red tip.
But you can't find the red tip, right?
Yeah. So
they finally, after 40-some years, the biggest innovation they had was they put a rubber band around the can. It used to be a cheap piece of tape that you could never get the tip back into.
Right.
Then they started, so they're like, okay, how do we solve this problem? Well, they started putting rubber bands on the can, right? 2 years ago, they came out with that new cap with the tip that, brilliant, right? I mean, just a great invention. They followed that up with putting WD-40 in a pen. Because what they found out was, through market research, is women didn't like using WD-40 with the straw. Because it sprayed all over the place, it was messy, they were intimidated by it. But women were okay using like the Tide bleach pen or the Clorox bleach pen. So all they did is they put WD-40 in a pen, and now women are comfortable, you know, oiling hinges or something that squeaks or getting a stain off the floor from a heel mark. So they're always looking for innovation, and so they came to Edisonation and said, okay, come up with something new. So no, you didn't have to have a patent. It didn't have to be a prototype. You just had to be able to describe what the product is.
To get this straight, this is always pulled from the companies. It doesn't go the other way.
Correct. Yeah, the casting calls for the TV show are the open searches. That's when we go into a convention center and people bring us ideas and it's a treasure hunt. We got to look through all the jewels and figure out which one's worth the most. Edison Nation, what we have found to be more successful for the inventor is we go to these retailers and manufacturers. They come to us and they say, this is where we're starving for innovation. This is the area where we need to fix a problem. This is an area where we see a lot of growth potential. Bring us this. We don't want to see the other stuff. Just bring us this. And we go to the world. I mean, we've actually had submissions from 137 countries so far. The world tells us their answers. And some of them are good. And some of them are bad. And some of them are absolutely brilliant. And if we can make those deals happen, then everyone benefits. It's not a solution to all problems out there. I mean, we still have to have entrepreneurs. We still have to have inventors who go out on their own. But at least for the searches we've got, it provides an opportunity. So what we find is that for real idea people, people who just love to solve problems, a lot of people just love to submit to every search. So when a search goes up from Clorox and they're looking for a new bleach product, someone in their garage says, you know what? I've got a great idea. I'm not going to quit my job. I don't want to become an entrepreneur. I don't want to start a business around this. But if this is the parameters of the challenge, I'll invest a couple hours to try coming up with a solution. Yeah.
What percentage of those requests do you fill?
So far, we're 100%. So far, every single search that we've done for a manufacturer or retailer has resulted in at least one licensed product. In fact, Coca-Cola was the only one that resulted in only one licensed product. Every other search has had at least two, if not more.
With my invention, I do want to establish, a business from it, from an entrepreneur sense. One, because a lot of manufacturing, is done outside of our country, and it's, needed that, as far as with the cost of having items, made, it's really a lot cheaper to get it done outside of the state. So how with trying to establish, to make one, to create jobs, and to be able to help, with the product, where having it made here, where it's less costly to being able to bring it to market, where you don't have to bring the pricing up so high.
It's a touchy situation. Ultimately, the consumer is going to make that decision. I mean, there was a time where Walmart advertised, made in the USA, and then consumers said, made in the USA isn't that important. We want everyday low prices. Mm-hmm. And so there are jobs created when products are made overseas. They're created in the selling of the products or marketing of the products. We create a lot of jobs in developing products. I mean, all those iPods out there, they're all made overseas, but they're all designed here in the United States. So ultimately, it's going to come down to the consumer making that decision. Are they willing to pay more for a product that's produced here? Now, that's not to say that there aren't industries here in the U.S. If a product's big and heavy and bulky and takes up a lot of space, most of the time it's got to be made here because it costs too much to ship it. Or in some cases, products that have to be turned quite often, it doesn't make sense to make them overseas. So there are still industries here in the U.S., and if you can come up with a product that can be manufactured here just as cost-effectively as overseas, that's great. But when you're asking those five questions and you talk with your customers and you ask them how much they're willing to pay, you got to figure out whether or not you can make money and still have it produced here in the U.S. Because what you may find is that the price that the consumer is willing to pay precludes that from occurring.
Now, of course, you can come up with a product that can be manufactured almost by a robot. So it can be done, just punch, 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 and come out. All of a sudden, the labor costs are low to manufacture, and then it can be done here again.
Yeah, resin doesn't cost less in China than it costs here. It's labor.
Yeah.
So if you've got a product that's injection molded, and it's a pretty automated process of basically the parts pop out, and you just they collect in a box, it's not going to be that much cheaper to make it in China as it is here. But if you have to take all those parts and you have to assemble it, and there's a lot of handwork involved, then they're going to beat us hands down because of the labor cost.
But that's the opportunity for invention of something that almost assembles itself.
That's right.
Yeah.
Or something the customer assembles, and any 5-year-old can do it. Laugh. But those are the directions for solving that problem.
But then you're getting back to accountability, though, because here you could get on a plane and go visit your manufacturer if there's a problem. Right now, we're working on something to try to get plastic balls made for a toy game. Everybody directs us to China. But here's the problem. They just instituted some national health safety design issues that can't have in PVC balls. The lead has to be removed. They have to be found. Now, what assurance do you have in a shipload of those coming over from China that they're going to be compliant?
It's a huge risk. Absolutely. And if you've never done it before, don't try doing it by yourself. What you need to do is work with a good agent or a good sourcing company that's done it before, that's got a proven track record. Because, I mean, what you don't want to do is you don't want to go to Alibaba.com or manufacturing.com and find some obscure Chinese manufacturer who quotes it at a low price, because you don't know what's coming back.
Absolutely.
And if you've ever done business in China, you realize that you're putting up the dollars before you receive the inventory. The counter sample that you receive, when you look at it, it looks right, but what's actually going to show up in that container 60 days later? they've already drawn on your letter of credit. They drew on that letter of credit when the container arrived at the port. So what you've got to make sure is that the quality is there. And so in many cases, having an in-country quality assurance company or actually spending a couple weeks in Guangzhou isn't a bad idea, because you can actually be there when your product's being manufactured. But one of the keys is, in this whole process of invention, is you need to surround yourself with good people. Don't try to do everything yourself. I mean, as much as you like to believe that you're capable of doing all of it, you need to work with people who have done it. Work with a good patent attorney who has success. Work with a good design firm and a good engineering firm. Work with a sourcing company. Work with a marketing company. Find the people who have got the track record, who can give you references. If you surround yourselves with the right people, the likelihood of being successful is that much greater. Any other questions?
Is it possible to get a copy of those slides?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Doug, do you want me to just...
Yeah, if you save it to the C drive, I'll put it in a podcast on the website.
Thank you.
Excellent.
If your invention already has patent protection, is there a different level of arrangement that you make with Edison Nation?
It's a one-size-fits-all. So what we don't do is we don't sit down and negotiate on every single deal. If it's not a good deal for the inventor shouldn't do it. In most cases, it's the opposite. In most cases, it's a pretty amazing deal for the inventor. I mean, think about it. If you woke up this morning with a great idea and someone is going to invest the dollars in it and you're going to get 50 cents out of every dollar that comes out of it, that's a pretty good deal. Now, on the flip side, if you've invested $300,000 in your product and you're this close from getting it to market, don't come to Edison Nation. Find other resources out there. Go to Edison Nation and talk with other inventors who may have an in somewhere or who can, you know, make an introduction for you. But on the other hand, we had an inventor come to Edison Nation, PhD from Stanford. He had 6 issued patents on a coffee cup lid. Spent 4 or 5 years trying to license it. Could not get in the front door anywhere. And so he submitted it, and this is the very first search we did on Edison Nation, which was an open search. So it was anything, and we were able to get the product to Solo Cup, to the CEO, and they're currently in an option period to license it. So in that situation, he had already exhausted every resource he had. He couldn't do it by himself, and so he just figured 50 cents of something was better than 100% of nothing.
Is that an exclusive, or...?
It is. In essence, what you're doing is when you're submitting it, you're agreeing to an option that if we get a deal done, then we're going to partner and share 50-50 in any revenues that are created.
I thought I heard you say 50-50 of the royalties, not of all the revenues. It's very possible that you can sell it to PetSmart and go out and sell it and have their own profit margin and make a lot of money.
It's 50-50 on anything that comes in. So it could be in the form of royalties, it could be in the outright purchase of the idea or the intellectual property. In some cases, we find that it may make more sense for us to actually produce the product, and then it's 50% of any revenue that's generated off the product.
And who decides which way you're going to go with that?
Sometimes it's dictated by the retailer. So if we bring a product to PetSmart, they may look at it and say, hey, we've got the overseas capabilities to manufacture this ourselves. We'll just pay you a royalty. They may look at the product and say, you know what, this product's better than what we're currently buying from this vendor, so we want this vendor to make it, and the vendor will pay the royalties. Or they may look at the product and say, we have no idea how you make this thing. You make it for us. Sell it to us. Here's a purchase order for 1 million units, and we'll produce it. We absorb all the costs associated with tooling up and manufacturing and the supply chain management. The inventor benefits in all three ways.
If there are two inventors, do you have to have both of them agree?
You know, first off, the inventors have already pre-agreed. So the inventors have agreed that if their idea is chosen, that they're going to enter into this agreement. The scenario, what happens if two inventors come up with the same idea and they're chosen? We really look at it two ways. First off, we're going to figure out who came up with the idea first. So we're going to see whether or not someone's got prior art, or a prior patent application or some way to determine, you know, who's the first to invent it. But in most cases, if this were to occur, and it hasn't occurred yet, is what we would do is we would just say, you know what, let's just all share. Right?
So what about co-inventors where one might want to make agreement, the other one might
want to
go his own way.
Well, if you...
That's not
going to
work.
Part of the application process is that you're actually... you are saying that it's your invention, that you own the invention.
Like, for example, a branded patent with two co-inventors.
Right. Each one owns 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you've got to... The only way we would allow that is if both inventors on the patent had agreed to the agreement.
Or anybody else. Nobody else would buy that deal if one inventor wanted it and the other one didn't.
Yeah, I mean, PetSmart's not going to take the product if the other inventor can then sell it to Petco.
Is there a time period that you analyze?
Typically, the search runs for 6 to 8 weeks, and then it takes about 4 weeks after the search is done to finalize the results and then present them to the manufacturer or retailer.
But I mean, after the person decides to go in 50-50 with you, what period of time are they in that 50-50 contract? Is that forever?
No, what we do is, in all fairness to the inventor and to us, is that we put minimum guarantees with the manufacturer or retailer on royalties that have to be earned in a 18, 24, and 36-month period. And so that gives them exclusivity as long as they meet those minimums. If they don't meet those minimums, then we have the opportunity to take that product anywhere else, which obviously is in our best interest as well as the inventor. I mean, anything that's good for us is good for the inventor and vice versa, right? I mean, we want to make money from it as well.
Absolutely.
Any other questions about inventions in general? Yeah?
I submitted something to the PetSmart submission, and it wasn't picked, but will it stay in the database to be used if something else is applicable?
It can, yeah. If you're a gold member, you can keep those ideas and you can resubmit them. There's no cost. So you can submit to every single search that it's applicable, and it doesn't cost you any more to do it. Once you've submitted once, you can resubmit. There will be other pet searches. I mean, PetSmart's already agreed to do two more searches, and we're actually launching, if it isn't up already, there's one for Bed Bath & Beyond is looking for, they're getting into pets in a big way. They're looking for bedding, feeding, and travel products. So yes, there will be other opportunities to resubmit. And just because your idea wasn't chosen for the first search doesn't mean it's not a good idea. It just didn't meet the criteria of what they were looking for on that search.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
Quick one, on a submission, what is the form of submission? Is it just written?
It's an online questionnaire. You can attach videos, you can attach pictures, you can attach pretty much any form of media to it. But there's a series of questions that guide you through it to help get to what the real idea is. But it's all online.
Simple, fast.
Yeah. And then the other things that there are on Edison Nation, you know, you can watch the previous two seasons of the TV show. You know, when you see these great clips with Dyson and Bezos and Napolitano and John Dudas and others, you can watch the full-length videos of those people, and that's all free as well. So, I mean, there's a lot of things on there. It's really interesting because we built it, but we didn't necessarily populate it. It's all of you that populate it. It's you in the forums talking about these things that really give Edison Nation the value.
Well, I'd like to...